Welcome back, one and all, to the Damage Report. I'm John. This is all. Jared Jackson, how's it going?
All the rest.
JR Wednesdays.
Yeah, you know, we might as well kick it off the right way. Coffee Bean or Starbucks?
I'm gonna definitely go for Coffee Bean. Starbucks.
You guys know the extent of which John just went in on Starbucks.
I know. I had some. I haven't had it in a long time, and I had it, and it's still bad. It's still really, really bad. I don't know how they're as successful as they are.
But the most important part of that is John is writing.
I'm trying, but anyway, we're not gonna get into that because it'll be really embarrassing. So we have a lot that we are going to talk about. So last night was election night. Was it a big blue wave? Was it a massive failure for the president? Or was it kind of good, kind of bad? We're gonna get into it. We've got a guest who's gonna be joining us to talk about Islamophobia in a really awesome book that she wrote. We've got Donald Trump's base polled on what it would take to get them to drop their support for the president. And really interesting findings. I also polled you guys for what would actually be enough to cause that. And so we're gonna show you those results. But then we've got the really sad case of Rodney Reed facing the death penalty right now. Jane Fonda on The View. And also Donald Trump's faith advisor is a lot of fun. I've been wanting to do it so far this week. And we're finally gonna get to talk about that a little bit. But first, the big news from around the country last night. Last night across America was election night. And depending on where you live, there might have been not much going on. You might have had a big gubernatorial race. Maybe there was important implications for the future of your city council. We had all of those. But I want to start off with the biggest result potentially. That is the headline grabbing contest between Democrat Andy Beshear and Republican incumbent Governor Matt Bevin in Kentucky. That was a big one. And even before last night, Donald Trump made very clear how important this race was. Here is what he said before Election Day.
You got to vote because if you lose, it sends a really bad message. It just sends a bad, and they will build it up. Here's the story. If you win, they're going to make it like ho-hum. And if you lose, they're going to say Trump suffered the greatest defeat in the history of the world. This was the greatest. You can't let that happen to me.
Weird relationship he has with his fans. So what did we get in the end? Narrow victory for the Democrat and thus the greatest defeat in the history of the world, even though it totally was not at all. But what is interesting is that Kentucky is a state that Donald Trump won by 30% just 3 years ago. And look, Bevin lost re-election, really important, although there are some wrinkles that we're gonna get into. But let's not go crazy just yet and assert that next year Mitch McConnell is going to be like pulling back into his shell and going off for retirement or something. Mm-hmm. All of the other statewide races went to the Republicans. Bevin is apparently was like among the most unpopular governors in the country at that point. And so it was going to be a tough re-election for him no matter what. So Donald Trump obviously went there to try to give him a chance. Now they're gonna get into how much blame does Donald Trump deserve? What are your initial thoughts?
Well, not surprising. You know, every time there's an election, you have to spin to see which way it's gonna go, or to see which way you'd like for everyone to perceive it to be that weren't paying close attention. So, I mean, we're in full spin mode now. You're gonna get into the many instances of it. But this is now, when you start talking about then the local races or the state races, or then the city council races, or then the school board races and all that stuff, then those are local and who knows whichever part of the state that's in and how that way that goes. But Donald Trump brought this on himself.
Yeah.
It's like, this is not about me. You can't let this happen to me. He's talking about Governor Bevin because that is a statewide seat. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that's gonna determine, not fully, but at least it has this feel that it could determine what's gonna happen statewide for the state when it goes to, say, the guy who just said it's about me. Mm-hmm. So again, what you wanna do, especially when you know that the governor is unpopular because he's a Republican and pulling Republican types of moves, is kind of like you want to endorse him, but not really tag your name to it. It's a normal political move. You're not supposed to directly say, hey, if he loses, I lose.
Yeah.
Come on, bro.
Well, it seems risky.
Yeah.
I think Donald Trump was fairly certain that, especially with him going in the last days of the race, I think he thought, no, we're gonna win this thing. It's still Kentucky. I won it by a ton. Republicans still mm-hmm. outnumber.
Yep.
Like I thought that was the case. It didn't turn out that way. So here are a few of the responses. So first, Donald Trump last night says hashtag election night won 5 out of 6 elections in Kentucky, including 5 great candidates that I spoke for and introduced last night. Matt Bevin picked up at least 15 points in last days, but perhaps not enough fake news will blame Trump, winning a Mississippi governor race, which they went on to actually win. So there he says that he picked up 15 points. That was a very close race. It was within like half a percentage point or something like that. So he said he picked up 15 points because of me, because I went there. Ronna McDaniel said picked up 17 points. We're gonna talk about this in a second, but it was Laura Ingraham's appearance. When she had Don Jr. on, she said he picked up 20 points thanks to Donald Trump. And the thing is, everyone was looking like far and wide, where are these polls that showed that the Republican incumbent governor was down by 15 to 20 points? And apparently, weeks ago, there was one from, I would not consider a reputable pollster, but had him down by a good amount. The thing was, it was just in the last few days, there was a poll that had them effectively neck and neck. Then Donald Trump goes there, and then the result is that they're roughly neck and neck with the Democrat being slightly up. So look, the idea that this guy losing is an indictment of Donald Trump, that doesn't really make a ton of sense. He didn't lose support because of Donald Trump, but Donald Trump was not able to hand him 5 or 10 percentage points of the electorate.
Yeah, as we're gonna talk about Laura Ingraham, if the power of Donald Trump came into the state to revive Matt Bevin, then what the easy next question, I know he wasn't actually getting interviewed, but the question that could be asked is, so what did you say to that crowd to get people who were either against Bevin to go his way, because you had such a big swing that you pulled so many more people that way, to make that happen? Mm-hmm. What is it you said that night?
Yeah.
What was the pull? No, it was nothing.
Yeah. And
they know who you are.
Look, Don Jr. went on and said this has nothing to do with Trump. Which again, I don't really care, but you know if this guy had won, they would have said it was due to Trump, obviously. Mm-hmm. As you pointed out, Laura Ingraham says that this is the testament to the power of Donald Trump. But this is so 1984. This is like, well, it turns out we produced, 10% more shoes than we predicted or whatever. So we're gonna go back and we're gonna say that we only thought we would do 5% more. So now it looks even better by comparison. You're just making up polls from the past to make it look like he gave some sort of bump. Why not just realistically look at the results and say, it looks like it was kind of a wash. Maybe it helped him a little bit, maybe it hurt him a little bit. And he ended up losing narrowly, which isn't that much of a shock because he was an incredibly unpopular incumbent.
Why was he an incredibly unpopular candidate?
And there you have to get into policy, but they don't want to do that. So hopefully, if this does actually, if the Democrat actually is sworn in, which is that's not guaranteed at this point, then that will be good for the state. The issue is that Matt Bevin, as of right now at least, is not conceding, as you'll see.
We know for a fact that there have been more than a few irregularities. They are very well corroborated, and that's all right. What they are exactly, how many, which ones, and what effect, if any, they have, will be determined according to law.
So here's the thing. He's being very vague in saying there were irregularities. He doesn't cite any particular ones. I have not seen any of his defenders cite any particular ones. But while that might seem sort of like, oh, look at this fool. He doesn't know when he's beat. Mm-hmm. It's actually a little bit scarier than that, because the Republican president of the state Senate is saying that they're going to look into this now. And the weird way that Kentucky works is it might end up being up to the state legislature to decide who won that race, dominated by Republicans. It is possible that they're just going to steal this from the Democrat, or at least intend to. They're giving every signal right now that that's what they're gonna do. The president of the Senate said, for instance, one really weird statement said, well, I've been looking at it and 2% of the vote went to this Libertarian candidate. That probably would have gone to the Republican. I don't know what would means, in that under what circumstance would the votes that didn't go to him go to someone else? There's not ranked choice voting in Kentucky. What are you talking about? And yet, it's this weird, he's just trying to like muddy the waters a little bit. Like, who knows? Democracy, it's a complicated thing. We're gonna dispense with it. We're just gonna have the Republicans choose.
The outward dismissal of democracy by this party consistently on every election basis, it's astounding. But I mean, it's not even astounding anymore. You can expect this by now. In North Carolina, when the Democrat won that governorship and they stripped him of all of his power, like whatever way they can do it, it's a different way every time. In Florida, when the voters gave the right to for ex-cons to vote and have some say in their government, no, not anymore. Forget that. We decided we don't like that.
Yeah,
because The people voted that way. We don't believe in the people. We don't believe in democracy.
Yeah, it's like I tweeted. It's not Republicans versus Democrats. It's Republicans versus democracy. They might get in through democracy because that's how you gain power. But once they have it, they do not feel beholden to maintaining that system. Now, there were a lot of other results. We're going to get into that a little bit later on in some bonus content for the YouTube channel. We do have to take a break, though. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a book after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Islamophobia is nothing new in American politics, but over the past few years, with things like the Muslim ban that Donald Trump was pushing for, some really high profile attacks against Muslim members of Congress, it certainly seems more out there, more aggressive. So let's get into this topic of this community and how America and many of its elected politicians view it and communicate with us. And joining us now to break this down is Dr. Nazita Lajavardi, professor at Michigan State University and author of Outsiders at Home, The Politics of American Islamophobia. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So, first of all, if we could start with the book, tell our audience a little bit about what you set out to accomplish in writing this book.
Sure, yeah. So, American Muslims are a group that we know very little about. This is a really hard group to measure for a number of reasons. So, the census doesn't collect data on religion. A lot of people who stem from the Middle East, for instance, have to identify as white on the census. So, we actually know very little about American Muslims and who they really are in American politics. So this book tries really hard to come up with a number of different ways to measure the Muslim sociopolitical experiences, particularly in a post 9/11 world. Mm-hmm. Because American Muslims weren't really surveyed prior to 9/11, because there are very few public opinion polls from the general public prior to 9/11 about Islam, Muslims, or even Muslim Americans, we don't actually know what the public even thought about them, you know? And so this book tries really hard to use the news media primarily as a lens to build a constructive sort of timeline of how Muslims have been discussed over time. So the book tries to do a number of different things, but really to assess the political discrimination of Muslim Americans.
And that makes a lot of sense because there's not that much information out there, at least historically. We sort of have a gut idea of what many Americans sort of how they view the community. I know in the past, looking at like warmth meters for different groups in American society, Muslims are down near the bottom. I don't know if they're lower than atheists, but those are basically the two groups that Americans are very confident that they don't like. Interesting is you wrote a paper, how negative sentiment towards Muslim Americans predicts support for Trump in the 2016 presidential election. And so this overall animus towards the community, it has some implications.
Oh, this is probably the most overlooked part of support for Trump right now. Muslim American resentment, which is basically 9 stereotype items that I've worked with a number of colleagues, but also generated, talk a lot about in the book. these attitudinal measures towards Muslim Americans, specific attitudinal measures towards Muslim Americans, they are important for predicting Trump support. You know, after party ID, it becomes Muslim American resentment. We think usually that it's racial resentment. These are traditional four items that political scientists and other scholars use to measure resentment, but it's actually not, right? It's Muslim American resentment that's more powerful in predicting support. And it's not just for Trump, right? It's also for a number of other policy arenas. So we cannot ignore it, particularly because it played such an impactful role in the 2016 election.
Doctor, I hear what you're saying and you have a lot of data to support it, but I read that it was actually just economic anxiety. So you should look into that.
Oh,
that
apparently
is all of what you're saying is nonsense and fake science. But anyway, so to just briefly turn to a more positive part of this, you had another paper, and this had to do with public opinion around the Muslim ban. And that actually had a more positive sort of outcome.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because we think that Muslim American resentment hit an all-time high after, you know, with the 2016 campaign and then even afterwards with the Muslim ban, right? We saw three iterations of a Muslim ban. It was upheld by the Supreme Court. This is something that we might think is mostly supported, right? That resentment is pervasive across the American electorate. Well, we found no, actually, a couple colleagues and I, Cassero Scully and Lauren Collingwood, we've done a couple of studies examining how the protests around the Muslim ban may have shifted individual level public opinion. And this work, I think, is really important because it shows that the information environment was really motivated around issues of American identity, right? Around the founding fathers and religious freedom, sort of really going back to the history of the United States. And what we find is that when people are strong and high on American identity, it really doesn't matter about your partisanship. You actually reduced support for the Muslim ban. And that reduction of support was actually something that stayed for up to a year later. So we see long-term public opinion shift, which has traditionally been very difficult to pinpoint, but on this issue with the Muslim ban, really around American identity. And we see that even right now being raised again with the impeachment, you know? Yeah. You see individuals in Congress bringing up this was, you know, impeachment is a tool of the founding fathers. It's incredibly important. We need to go back to those times. So, you know, American identity is very strong. We shouldn't undercut it.
So what you had said earlier about the anti-Muslim animus driving support for Trump more than traditional racial resentment towards other groups, I had not known about that. That is very interesting. I am assuming, though, that the apparently quite savvy and data-driven Trump election team in 2016, they probably came across that information at some point. And I wonder, I know that you're talking about large communities over multiple years. It's harder to talk about specific cases, but recently, new representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib have been elevated as constant targets of attack by Donald Trump and by surrogates in Republican media. Does that potentially explain why these representatives who don't wield a ton of individual political power are being put on the same level as a Nancy Pelosi or a Chuck Schumer on the national stage?
Yeah, look, far be it for me to dismiss Islamophobia as a root cause of why we see overwhelming attention on women of color, especially Muslim women of color. It's hard for me to know exactly what's driving the disproportionate attention on these women, but it's not lost, I think, on many of us in academia and as well as stakeholders and policymakers that there is a disproportionate amount of attention on these two women. I mean, where is the attention on Andre Carson, right? Where was the similar attention on Keith Ellison, two other Muslim members of Congress, right?
That's
that
true.
Intersectional space that women of color, women, Muslim women occupy, I think cannot be ignored, you know? And it's not something that I've actually looked into. I know a couple colleagues are beginning to look into this, but you know, very little data exists. And I think it's important for us to be mindful that these sorts of biases, sexism, you know, Islamophobia might be driving.
They might have a stronger effect than the sum of their parts. And that's a great point about Keith Ellison, by the way. I hadn't thought of that. Dr. Nazita Lajavardi, thank you so much for joining us. I would love to talk to you once we're a little bit farther into the campaign to see if perhaps my little prediction there might play out some more.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, though, a couple stories I really want to get into, one of which talking about what it would take for some of the more hardcore supporters of Donald Trump to cut their support for him. We're going to speculate a little bit here after this. With all of Donald Trump's broken promises and his failures as a president, as a leader, as a dad, it might make you wonder, what could he actually do that would cause his hardcore supporters to finally stop supporting him? And it turns out that for a significant chunk of the American public, there is nothing he could do that would result in that. Take a look at this statistic. 62% of people who approve of the job that Donald Trump is doing as president say they can't think of anything he could do that would cause him to lose their support, according to a poll that came out just yesterday. Now, that's not 62% of the American public. That's of those who approve of him, which is like 40% of the country. So we're talking like 25%. Like one out of four of the people you cross in the street, they, with whatever imagination they have, can't imagine anything. That's depressing.
This leads to the thought about what he had said before about he can do whatever he wants and they'll always support him. So much to the suggestive mind of so many voters, and all politicians do it, maybe not all, but many do it, where they'll tell the American people what it is that they believe and what they want, instead of saying, hey, I talked to Americans, this is what they believe and this is what they want. You just suggest it to them, and then a significant percentage, in this case, 25% of his supporters at least, or 62%
of his supporters
believe so. So it works to a certain extent. Just say it, be like, you know what? I can do this and you're gonna support me. And a certain number of people will go, I will.
There was one example of that that you probably remember. That was the Fifth Avenue thing with the gun. That came up because CNN's New Day, is it Allison Camerota?
Yeah, Allison.
Yeah. So she was talking with swing voters, not people who might swing one way or the other, but people who live in areas that might swing one way or the other. And she talked with a woman named Crystal, and she said, Crystal, is there anything he could do that would make you not vote for him? She said, no. Camerota said, if he shot someone on Fifth Avenue, would you vote for him? Another panelist jumped in, you'd have to know why he shot him. And Crystal said, yeah, why did he shoot him? And I'm left wondering, wait, yeah, why did he shoot him? What did he do? But anyway, yeah, so even with the prospect of this person being a cold-blooded murderer, that is not enough. And so I then thought, okay, well, perhaps we're a little bit more imaginative than some of these people who were polled. What do we think? What do you guys who watch the Daniel Report, what do you think he could do that would finally get through to this one out of four Americans? And we have some suggestions. Let's evaluate them.
Yeah.
Thor Benson said, tank the economy or support abortion. J.R. Jackson, would either or both of those result in finally getting through these people?
Well, we're talking about which kind of tanking of the economy, because the economy's tanking for most normal Americans. It's just so we go by the realm of what's Wall Street talking about? Mm-hmm. What are the rich doing? How's the stock market doing? Stock market doesn't affect me and the large majority of Americans. So in my opinion, he's already doing one of those. But it's probably the—
maybe abortion?
I want to say it, but they don't care.
I mean, he did back in the day. That didn't get through to them.
Exactly. They don't care about children.
I don't think it would. I can't necessarily make a well-crafted argument about how he would get around that, but I don't think that that's core enough
to
their support.
Because the same thing, you're talking about getting shot on Fifth Avenue and the lady jumped in or the other person jumped in and said, why did he shoot him? They'd go, well, why does he support abortion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, like in terms of that area, the moral values Republicans, he fails on every other one of those measures. So why would this be the one? In terms of tanking the economy, no. He would simply say it's the Democrats that did it. It's the media that did it. He's already trying to do that. He's already prepped for that. So I don't think about that. Abortion, maybe. Bioallergical woman said ban assault weapons and abolish ICE. I think this one might be onto something. So if he were to ban assault weapons, if he were to do a Beto O'Rourke style gun buyback, a mandatory buyback, what about that?
That one's tough.
I think that
one I don't think they can get by.
I don't think so. It's not that they support him only because they love guns. They could support any Republican for that. But I think that the other reasons that they support him, we just had an interview where it was about anti-Muslim sentiment, and obviously there's some racism as well. That's not disconnected from wanting to be armed, I don't think.
The basis of their reality would say he's been compromised. Someone's got him. oh my God, this isn't our Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So they would withdraw their support, but it would still be with the condition of someone's made him do this.
Yeah. Chicken Bone Watt said, lose. And there were a lot of people who said, if he were to lose, they will flee him like they fled Palin. What do you think about that? If he were to lose in 2020?
Yeah.
You think?
I mean, he's not in power anymore, so there's no more of
the
support.
Yeah, it matters
right?
less.
It's like, yeah, he's gone. I can't. They would still complain about what has been done to him. The media finally took him down with those radical Dems, you know, all that. So that again, it was all based in conditions. Because what happens is they would leave him in some of these instances, but there needs to be some kind of a rationale in their head as to why they supported someone who would do this to them and flip.
Yeah.
Something he did that someone else made him do. Made me lose my support for him.
I think he would be a living martyr at that point. I think he would go do Trump TV. They would love that. They would attack the other Republicans for not defending him enough. They'd attack the Democrats, obviously. I don't think that they would go away just because he lost. I mean, whenever you try to imagine what would cause them to abandon him, they have to abandon him to go to something, because these people have now tasted the sweet, sweet juice of culthood. And you can't just all of a sudden just go back to like, oh, I'm a person who gardens. That's not going to be enough for these people, I don't think. There has to be something, which is why I think we should be looking for who is the Republican who is going to try to set himself up as the one to take over. There's a lot that think they are. Ted Cruz definitely thinks that. I don't think Ted Cruz has it. He doesn't have that juice when it comes to the culthood.
Some people they don't like Ted Cruz.
Exactly. Some people also jumping ahead said if he were to die, no, I think that they will talk about him.
Oh.
You think that they held on to Reagan's ghost for a long time? You're going to be hearing about Donald Trump from Republicans for a long, long time.
Martyrdom, exactly what they would be looking for in that instance.
Is there anything else that you think would do it?
Man.
I mean, from that interview, I would now say, and some people suggested, what if he were to befriend Ilhan Omar? I think that if he were to, but honestly, I don't know, we had that crazy Crystal Globe party with the Saudis. I think that might do it if he were to, really substantively renounce white supremacy, white nationalism, Christian supremacy. That could potentially break through, because that's what's really core to the entire thing, is that the identity politics of white resentment.
Yeah, because that's always been the driving factor, as you mentioned before in the last interview. The lie that it's about, you know, supporting the little man.
Yeah.
So not
and
the reason.
Anxiety.
So the real reason is because of the supremacy nature of his candidacy and how he's going to stick it to everyone else that doesn't like him. Once that's gone, the shine, the glow is gone.
I think so. So I had tweeted you guys, what do you think would do it? And apparently this is something that people have a lot of thoughts on, because there were 1,500 responses. So just in case we missed any areas, feel free if you're watching this on YouTube to go down in the comments and what do you think would cause them to finally abandon Trump? We do have to take a break though. We're gonna take a short one. When we come back, Rodney Reed facing the death penalty for a crime that he apparently did not commit. We'll give you the details after this. As of this week, more and more people around the country are getting fired up about an ongoing case of extreme injustice that there might still be time to correct. And it involves Rodney Reed, who you're seeing there. For 21 years, Rodney Reed has been on death row while fighting to prove his innocence. The now 51-year-old was convicted of murdering Stacy Stites on April 22nd back in 1996. Reed, a black man, and Stites, a white woman, were in a consensual relationship, although the latter was engaged at the time to former police officer Jimmy Fennell, who you're gonna wanna remember because he becomes pretty important in this story. In 1998, 2 years after the death of Stacy Stites, Reed was found guilty by an all-white jury. That's justice in America right there. The issue is that he has been saying the entire time that he did not do it. And there are some pretty convincing reasons to believe that. When Stites was killed, authorities discovered DNA that matched Reed's, leading the jury to find him guilty. His legal counsel claims that the DNA was a result of his and Stites' relationship, which is certainly conceivable. Also, the murder weapon, a belt, was never tested for DNA, and requests for its examination have been refused by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. His fingerprints were nowhere to be found. I mean, that right there, that's not even the worst part of this, but the fact that you have a murder weapon and you're like, I don't wanna look into it. And he's been saying for more than 2 decades that he's innocent. You can't spare an hour? That's I mean, that's really weird.
That's blatant. That's a blatant approach to this to make sure that you eliminate evidence that could potentially find the full truth. Mm-hmm. And then you go with the things that will get the results that you were looking for. It's the way our legal system has been for many folks throughout our history of this country.
Yeah.
So even just that one potential defense for the reason why the DNA was even anywhere near her because of their relationship actually angers these types of folks more.
Oh, totally, 100%.
The reasoning is actually more like, oh yeah, it definitely was. That's right. We're gonna get you for that too.
Yeah, I mean, this not testing the murder weapon. That'd be like, I can't find my keys. And you were to ask me, well, did you look in your pocket? I'm like, no. And you're like, well, shouldn't you? No, I'm not gonna do that. I seem like a crazy person at that point. This is clearly a way that you get more information. A person's life, potentially about to be killed, is on the line. And it's important to bear in mind that initially, when she was killed, he was not the initial suspect. The initial suspect was her fiance, Jimmy Fennell. Then they found the DNA. And at that point, although Rodney Reed said that they were in a consensual relationship, nobody would apparently back that up. And so they thought, oh, well, then that clearly ties him in a way that nothing else does to her. But it turns out that now we know that multiple witnesses are saying that no, they were in fact in a relationship. But more important than all of that is information that came out a little bit later on. While on duty, former police officer Fennell reportedly kidnapped and sexually abused a woman, receiving a 10-year sentence. While in prison, he met an inmate named Arthur Snow Jr., who was part of the Aryan Brotherhood gang. Fennell sought protection from Latino and black inmates, so he attempted to befriend Snow, according to a sworn 3-page affidavit. Within the passage, Snow claims that Fennell confessed to the murder and bragged about Reed's predicament. And so that individual, Snow, is now a potential witness in this, says that the guy said that he killed her. This is a police officer who has multiple other instances of violence against women. The idea that we're just, you know, I think we nailed it in the late 90s, that is absurd.
And as soon as it happens, okay, so you talk about, first off, this former police officer was in prison on 10 years for doing exactly what happened to his former fiance, except for the murder part.
Except for the murder, but an assault against
a
woman.
And kidnapping someone. And then when he's in prison, admits to it. So if you don't want to believe what another prisoner is saying about this officer who revealed to him what he did, then just go with the fact that he's done it before. That's what he's in prison for. It's like you don't need to connect too many dots. That's what he's in prison for right now.
Yeah.
So let's flesh this whole thing out. I'm not saying because of one crime, the other one is automatically, he's guilty of that one as well. But that's your track record to go, maybe we should look into this a little bit further. Yeah. Relitigate the problem because it's not conclusive at this point.
Yeah, and multiple other witnesses like Snow have said that Fennell had talked about his sort of growing hatred and anger towards her. Apparently his rage at the fact that she had been sleeping with a black man. That seems like the sort of person for a person who is already incredibly violent, sexually violent towards women, that could potentially set them off. And obviously is a reason to want to search for more evidence, especially the stuff that's sitting there right in front of you. Check the murder weapon to see if his DNA is there, assuming that after 20 plus years, that's still possible.
It's just a matter of what your motivations are. If your motivation gets to the truth, or if your motivation is to make sure that you get this one guy.
Yeah.
If your motivation is that, and you've already done that, so you have no other thing you want to take care of.
You're
like, well, I don't want the truth. I got a guy.
Yeah, and look, if you're still not sure about this, looking for more evidence does not like free him tomorrow. There's no reason not to. There is no rush to kill a person.
Yep.
And so if you would like this to go forward, people have been doing a lot of social media activism around this, trying to put pressure. There's also a change.org petition that had just about 300,000 signatures as of earlier today. You can find that there pretty easily. Anyway, look, whether it turns out in the end that he did it, and there's many good reasons to believe that he did not, allowing this to go forward without getting all the evidence possible, that is a terrible, terrible precedent. A precedent that's been set many times before, but there's no reason that in 2019 that we still should.
Yeah, there's no reason, but we'll, you know, we like to hang on to the old ways. You know, we still got politicians that talk about the good old days and talk about the way things used to be in America. They long for those times.
This is a case study for those good old days from a certain point of view. Okay, let's move on now to a very different topic there. Over the past couple of weeks, actress and activist Jane Fonda has been arrested multiple times during climate change related protests. Recently, actually just yesterday, she was on The View to talk about this. And she was talking about how important it is that we address this issue. Abby Huntsman had some concerns though.
Here's the problem that I have, because I'm for climate change. I'm worried about the fires. I'm worried about the hurricanes. I lived in Beijing. I woke up every day with pollution. You can't even open your eyes. It's serious. But right now, the conversation that's being had about a $93 trillion Green New Deal, and on the other side, having climate deniers, we're not having a conversation as a country. No. And that's frustrating to me. And I think part of the problem is this political hyperbole. When you have AOC saying, don't have kids anymore, you should really think about that, or we shouldn't ride on planes anymore, or this Green New Deal, that where is that getting us? I worry that you go to such extreme measures.
No, the
measures.
Green New Deal is fantastic, and how to
pay
for it.
But it's never going to happen. That's never going to happen in this country.
We, American taxpayers, subsidize the fossil fuel industry that's killing us to the tune of $16 billion every year. I mean, that is just, that's criminal.
So what can we do?
But that's not going to bring the climate deniers into a room to have a conversation.
The military budget, which is totally bloated and bigger than any other developed country, $600 billion. That'll fund Medicare for All, and that would fund the Green New Deal in large part. That's been proven by Forbes magazine.
So look, Jane Fonda has been doing a great job in her activism. I was actually able to, when she came to the LA climate march recently, I was able to hear her speech. I was like 5 feet away from her. It was pretty awesome. She's doing a great job. She did a great job there on The View. Abby Huntsman though, that was frustrating to watch.
This is a perfect illustration of political conversation when it's about something that's based in fact and numbers. Mm-hmm. And then one group decides to ignore the simple facts and the simple numbers behind it and believe craziness. So when someone spots off seven things that are cartoonish in their approach, and it's the opposition that has to be like scientific, direct, and, mm-hmm. and clear and concise so that these idiots can pick up on it. But even when you are, they go, but what about the killing babies part? What about the never eating meat again? So when we mention the numbers, the amount of money that you spend that goes to fossil fuel industry, but you don't care about that. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, how are we gonna pay for everything else? Do you care about how much we pay for the wars? Do you care about how much we pay, again, as Jane Fonda mentioned, these industries that continue to screw us over? You don't care about that part. But as soon as that's brought up, did Abby Huntsman go, you know, that makes sense? Mm-hmm. No,
nope.
She went back into, but what about the Green New Deal?
She's not there to either make sense or acknowledge when sense has been made. We're gonna have more from her in a second, but I wanna say that I don't normally watch The View. Usually it's a few things will sort of make news, I'll mm-hmm. take a look at it. So I don't go into watching a clip like that really knowing much about Abby Huntsman, except for, of course, the lineage thing where, like with Meghan McCain, her career began because of her last name and who her family was. That is a huge issue in the media. It's an issue we don't take seriously enough, obviously. And the thing is, I'm sure that Abby Huntsman is very smart. I'm sure she went to a far better school than me. She's far more powerful and influential than I will ever be. But she sits at that table to say vapid, ridiculous things like she did just there. It's like, oh, I know that we have the bulk of the world scientists saying that we need to do something about this. Just yesterday, there was 11,000 scientists who said this is an emergency.
They're all getting paid.
And then you have on the other side, apparently balancing it, you have climate deniers. And why aren't we having a conversation? Maybe because there's no conversation to be had with those people. If their identity is not accepting science, like with Greta being asked about why she won't sit down with Trump, I am not going to waste my time when there's so much to do. And Abby Huntsman is technically smart enough to know that. But she's there to push for status quo friendly, centrist friendly civility. Let's have things that we promote and we care about, but let's not be mean about it. Let's be civil with each other. Why don't we spend the next 75 years having a conversation with the literal dumbest people on the planet about something that we have a couple of years to solve? And if that sounds too harsh, you just watched the clip. You saw her spreading lies about the Green New Deal that have been debunked
exactly.
on this show 50 times across media. What is it, a few thousand? And still, months and months after the Green New Deal comes out, she's saying that AOC is banning plane travel and banning meat and saying you can't have any kids. And she's paid fabulously to do that every day, to sit there, to lie to her audience and to confuse the issue. And by the way, they have Meghan McCain there to make Abby Huntsman look reasonable by comparison, but she's not reasonable. Abby Huntsman should be the crazy on the panel if she's gonna be there at all.
Because there has been moments when Abby Huntsman on that show has had to jump out and say something after McCain says something that's insane and be like, well, yeah, that doesn't really make much sense. I'm a Republican, but it doesn't really wanna go that far. Mm-hmm. So there's this legitimacy factor, which, by the way, I take her sincerity in how she believes this. This is how it works. People who have good intentions, I don't know hers, but people who have good intentions will buy into it because it's simple. If you just throw someone a simple equation, they go, well, that makes sense, I guess, because everyone keeps saying it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. That's what our president continues to do over and over again. Then you're like, well, yeah, I guess that's really the case because I've heard it like a million times. Yeah. I also heard that somehow 11,000 scientists are getting paid so fabulously that they're willing to all collectively lie about this and not the fossil fuel industries or the lobbyists or the politicians who are all paid off and supported in this factor. Who's making money off of this again?
Yeah.
It lands on its face. The logic of it lands on its face. Scientists are getting paid, but somehow the fossil fuel industry isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's supposed to be more reasonable. It's like, I accept the science, and then insert reason to not do anything about it. That's not better than climate denial. It's actually worse, because we are savvy enough as environmentalists to know that there's no point in wasting our time on the climate deniers anymore. But there might be some people who can be convinced to waste their time trying to appeal to people like Abby Huntsman, who technically agree on the science, but don't feel any urgency whatsoever in actually doing anything about it. That is more dishonest than climate denial at this point. If you support doing nothing, I don't give a damn about what science you support. In the end, it's just as destructive to the earth and its climate. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, we're gonna be moving to Donald Trump's faith advisor, who is certainly something after this. This week, many Americans were introduced to Paula White, the pastor and faith advisor to Donald Trump. Faith is something that he swears is really important to him. So the person who's advising him on that, very important. In case you have not seen some of her work, here's a little bit.
To say no to President Trump would be saying no to God. And I won't do that.
We are in a spiritual war right now. Let every demonic network that has aligned itself against the purpose, against the calling of President Trump, let it be broken. Let it be torn down in the name of Jesus.
You want me to tell you what my thoughts are? The thoughts of the King of Kings, the thoughts of the Lord of Lords. I'm downloading heaven. Hey!
There's a Department of Treasury in heaven that God is watching over everything you do. And you are storing up eternal treasure that will go so far beyond, I think, that we can even begin to imagine. You need to send in $3,500. You need to send in $35,000. You need to send in that $100,000 check. If you do not write that P.O. box and you do not call that toll-free number and you do not become a ministry of sustainer, you will never see sustainment in your life and your dream will die. Your call will die.
That was threatening for a religious message there. So that last little bit, we're gonna return to that, the request for money. But there was some other stuff in that video, JR. What do you think about his faith advisor?
This is the perfect faith advisor for this president, who this is the kind of faith he's got. It's fake. It's seeking money. It's using people that are in a different position that will praise you in order to get that money. So it's perfect. It sets up perfectly. We've seen him go to Liberty University and quote 2 Corinthians. We've seen him get asked about his favorite Bible verse, and he says the whole damn thing.
All of them.
And which one? Old or New Testament? The semi-New Testament? So if he knows nothing about faith or religion or Christianity or any of that, in fact, he despises it. So does she, except she found a way to use it to make money the way he did. So this is a perfect marriage.
Yeah, and look, we had another video. We don't have time to play it, but it was a whole bunch of an earlier thing where she's talking to her audience and saying, if you want to succeed in life, you need to sacrifice. By giving me money, you need to give me $100, you need to give me $1,000. I don't care how hard you're struggling, I don't care what your problems are. Whatever money you have, give that to me. Whatever money you don't have, get some money, then give that money to me. I don't want to. I'm not 21 anymore. I don't want to offend religious people just for the fun of it. But she's a fake. Doubt she even believes in God. Yeah. She's in it for the money. And there's a ton of people that are like that. The prosperity gospel people, they're frauds. And it is a shame that so many people get hoodwinked by them. Reverend William J. Barber, a religious leader who I have a lot of respect for, said, "It's an attempt to interpret the gospel to be primarily about personal wealth and personal power, which is contrary to the theology of Jesus, where the good news was always focused on caring for the poor, the least of these, the stranger, the sick." She can't do that because she's too busy buying multi-million dollar mansions and planes for herself.
Yeah, and because, you know, the poor, the least, the stranger, and the sick can't give her money to help enrich her. So who cares about them? They're done.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, I don't want to offend people, but speaking in tongues is not a thing. I mean, you like at that point, come on, wake up. What are you listening to? I know it's a thing, and I know she ran a Pentecostal church. It's a thing that's done by certain sects of Christianity, but like, if all of the rest of that doesn't clue you into the con that she's running, at that point, it certainly should.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are gonna have a little bit of overtime. There's some other election results. We do wanna get into that. So this is gonna be available on YouTube later on. And also, if you're a member, you can watch it. So become a member so that you can do that. Results from around the country. So expect that in just a little bit. We're gonna take a quick break, and then we'll see you on the other side.
You don't have to send us money.
No, you don't. But please
just get it.
Last night, election night, had some huge high-profile wins that we've talked about, including Bevin going down in his re-election bid in Kentucky. Apparently, we'll see. But there were a lot of other important results from across the country yesterday. So let's just briefly skim across a few of them. Very importantly, Democrats won complete control of the Virginia government for the first time in a generation. Democrats have cleared the way for Governor Ralph Northam, who you might have heard about in the news, who was nearly driven from office earlier this year to press for measures tightening access to guns and raising the minimum wage that have been stymied by legislative Republicans. Because it's great to get a governor of your party, but if the state legislature is controlled by the other side, it's not as good as it could be.
So these are some of the things. So this is the opportunity now. As these, you know, you have complete control of the entire state for the first time, and he said
in a generation. So 20, 30 years.
This is when Democrats need to stop acting like recent memory Democrats that go, "Well, this is the first time we've had this. Let's be very careful with this." And everyone told us they want us to come and do this one thing, but let's just kind of do it because we don't want to ruffle too many feathers. The feathers are ruffled against your opponents. That's why you were voted in. Please go in and do the job that the American people that voted you in told you to do.
It's like, "Oh, they chose us. I don't want to scare anyone. Don't move. Okay, everybody, hide. Hide under your desk." And so for the next couple of years, it's just like the Republicans, and then it's like suits peeking out from under desks. But that's what they do. And not just at the state level. Nancy Pelosi was brought in to hold Donald Trump accountable. She's brought in theoretically for a lot of other things, but passing legislation was inherently gonna be very difficult with a Republican Senate and a Republican president. What you can do is hold him accountable. And it took so long for her to move in support of impeachment. After impeachable offense, after impeachable offense, don't do that, Virginia, or else we might have to wait another generation.
If nothing else progresses, you mentioned the Nancy Pelosi part. If nothing else, they can at least go to the point that she and Schiff were so reluctant to finally start the impeachment inquiry, that you can say, "You know what? Remember how much they were denying against the whole impeachment thing? This must be really serious anytime these losers, these weak politicians actually make a move. It must be overwhelming."
Yeah.
Like, you can use that at least now.
Three-dimensional loser chess. Yes, okay, let's turn to another area. So this is Democratic Socialism and a number of different DSA-backed candidates. Of the baker's dozen candidates endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America's National Committee, at least three won seats in cities like Philadelphia and Charlottesville, with a fourth apparently likely to win in San Francisco as well. In Philadelphia, the DSA-backed independent candidate Kendra Brooks won her city council seat by over 10,000 votes, flipping a slot held by Republicans for generations. So not just one generation. So that is really exciting, especially when you delve into individual cases of this. They're not just winning in the most out and out crazy leftist districts. They're winning in purple districts, the places that we have been told this sort of ideology will tank the Democratic Party. Apparently not so much.
So again, this needs to be shouted from the rooftops. Okay, so then this particular group that's pushing these progressives to do these different things are getting some level of success. 4 out of 13, the baker's dozen. That's movement, that's something. So highlight it. We talked earlier about how Trump and then Trump Jr. and then Ingram and everyone on Fox News is talking about some, "Well, you know, they got shellacked in Virginia, and yeah, they lost the governor's race in Kentucky, but that's the power of Donald Trump." Yeah. Like, somehow, no matter what, the result, or at least the answer, is still positive. When it is positive in this case, point it out. Yeah. No one will know unless you. No one's gonna buy it unless you go ahead and sell it.
Exactly.
And it's our. And apparently, it's flying off the shelves.
Yeah. And one other, there were obviously more candidacies. We'll get into a few more, but there were also important ballot measures. And so one, we had, I believe it was a city council member, it might have been a state legislator, on a couple of weeks ago to talk about New York's effort to pass ranked choice voting. And we talked about the likelihood at that point a few weeks ago about whether it could pass. And we weren't really sure. It's a big change. This would be by far the biggest city to do it. Fast forward to yesterday, and New Yorkers overwhelmingly backed a system of ranked choice voting, which allows voters to rank candidates in order of preference rather than selecting only their top choice. If you would like to know why that is better, we've done a number of videos on the channel on it. Just go to our channel and search ranked choice voting. We've had a bunch of different experts on to talk about the various benefits.
The more of democracy at work, so it gives people more of a chance to see what they really want. It's crazy, like when people have the power to see or to see what they want, and then politicians are put in place that will carry that out. I think that people might be happier with
that. Yeah, and that means that we're gonna see more third-party bids without the worry about being a spoiler or whatever, but also you get greater representation. That's just what experiments have shown, both in terms of who runs for these offices and also overall who wins in ranked choice voting systems. You have greater diversity amongst politicians.
There's gray area in politicians. There's so much of the black and white. Oh, if you don't think this way, you're not a Republican. If you don't think just this way, you're not a Democrat. There's a lot of gray areas. So when you have this many candidates, you get a chance to choose that rank.
Yeah.
There's levels of which you're supporting certain folks for certain reasons.
Yeah. There were several firsts last night. So Ghazala Hashmi, a Democrat, was the first Muslim woman elected to the Virginia Senate. In Arizona, Regina Romero was headed towards victory in the Tucson mayor's race, becoming the first woman and the first Latina to lead that city. So that's exciting too. And we have another sort of first that I want to get into. So in Virginia, Denica Rome made history on Tuesday night as the first openly transgender politician to win re-election in a state legislature. Yeah. And that's the sort of first that I want. Because when it's 2019 and you have like the first statewide African American elected official, that's great and that's progress, but it's also like 2019, that's the first. No, I want it's like the first one elected for the fifth time in a row or something like that. Like I want something that enshrines that we still have more diversity and God, and not a reminder of how long it's taken for certain communities to have any representation at all.
Yeah, I point out before when someone was saying how they wonder why when these freshman congresswomen came in that everyone's talking about squad and what it'll be as far as the future for politics. And I was like, we need a confirmation election first for me to be, not convinced, but for me to feel a little more comfortable with it. At that the nation actually picks up on what it is that they're doing and that their ideas are taking us in a certain direction. So it's very important for that next confirmation to be like, okay, we trusted them, we saw what they wanted to do, and then we still believe in it.
Yeah. That's
so the confirmation vote in this is such a good sign.
Yeah. There was just one other race I want to talk about, and this one just because it's a little bit funny.
Mm-hmm.
So you might remember years ago, Donald Trump was in a motorcade and he was driving, and there was a photograph of a woman on a bicycle giving the motorcade the finger. That woman lost her job because of that. But as of last night, she has a new job. Julie Briskman, she won a seat on the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors 2 years after losing her job because of giving middle finger to Donald Trump.
And apparently she won that not strictly because of the middle finger, but because of
I'm sure, yeah.
I mean, but that's enough of a rally cry. People knew about it. I remember that. It's enough of a rally cry that at least her name is out there, but then using that, at least that promotion, I guess, but the demotion from her job. Mm-hmm. But that promotion to then give her ideas of what she would do in office, and apparently it worked out. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it wasn't by any means all Democratic victories. Republicans in Kentucky won almost all of the statewide races. Mm-hmm. Mississippi, they appear to have won the governorship. They might still be able to steal the Kentucky governorship, so they've got that going for them. But a lot of really interesting results. And while you should not in any way become apathetic going into the 2020 election, it's nice to win some.
Yeah. There's still, you know, there's still Republicans in the country.
There are. Yeah.
You know.
It's going to take 2 to 4 more years to get rid of them. Anyway, so that's it for the show. Thank you for sticking around, not only for the show, but also for the overtime. Really appreciate that. Thank you, JR, for joining me as always on Wednesdays. And lots more planned for the rest of the week. So we will see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.